You are listening to Punk News Podcast episode 440, the Mott the Hoople episode. And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast, and today we're going to be talking about Mott the Hoople and nothing but Mott the Hoople. We're going to be talking about the early stuff, you know, Wildlife. We're going to be talking about Brain Capers and, of course, the David Bowie era, all the young dudes all the way through the Hoople album, and even the post-Mott the Hoople bands, Mott, as well as Ian Hunter's solo stuff. So we're just going to dig in and talk about Mott the Hoople, nothing about Mott the Hoople. Adam, are you excited to talk about Mott the Hoople tonight?
In your intro and the start of this, for some reason, whenever you said Mott, Your voice glitched out like you were coming out of the Matrix. So it was like Mott. I think it'll be a fascinating effect on the published version of this show. Am I excited to talk about this thing that you're making up? No, I've had enough, John, of being thrust into conversations I don't think that I should be exposed to the world. Putting my foot down. Mm. I'm referencing yesterday. Ooh. We did a podcast yesterday. About Descendants, and I don't know, it went better than I thought, actually. But I gotta say, doing two shows in 2 days is really it's fucking up my schedule.
We're already tired. We haven't even started yet.
This is gonna be a show.
Well, that's Tom Trauma, and let's get right into it. That's Tom.
You know, Trauma. John. You know, John. When I was a kid, like, so my name's Tom. Obviously, Tom is my Christian name, not Tom Trauma. That's my punk name I made up when I was 19 that I've somehow managed to cling to for all these years.
It's your prison name.
Well, now it is now. Well, now it's like, it's such a long running joke that it's like, I always laugh about it as being my, but anyway, like a lot of youngsters, when I was first writing my name and I was like 3 years old, I would write it backwards. So my earliest writings were signed Mott Trauma.
Well, Tom, you are a man of good taste. And, you know, I got to say, man, I know a lot of the quote punk rockers. They're like 30, 35. They're like, oh, I'm so old. It's like, yeah. Like you punkers are out till 2 a.m. I'm happy if it shows over by 10:30 p.m. I'm old. Let me tell you, people, let on Monday, I saw Adam White's favorite band. I saw Mott the Hoople, Ian Hunter, Ariel Bender, and the other guy, the three guys that are still alive. Yeah. And
I'm sure the other guy is highly honored to be referred to as the other guy.
He was cool. He was cool. Ian Hunter is literally 79 years old. Literally 79 years old.
I mean, your grandparents have to be like that age, right? You guys?
Well, my grandparents are dead, but thanks, Tom. I appreciate that.
Well, my grandparents are in their mid-80s. And I'm 10 years older than you guys. I'm trying to put two and two.
How does this work? My grandparents, they're all passed, but like my grandparents were like, they were in their 90s. My grandfather was like 99 10 years ago.
Son of a gun. You guys talk without me a minute. I'm getting a call.
Your grandparents calling you? Thomas, are you talking about?
I got to take this real quick. You guys talk without me. I'll be back.
So anyways, Adam, even though Tom has freakishly young grandparents, Ian Hunter was 79. And he does not. I'm not convinced that that's not actually Ian Hunter up there. He looks like he's about maybe 45 or 50, but more so, you know, when you get to be a certain age, you kind of start to move differently. You don't have quite the vim, the finger, the snap. You know, you kind of get a certain more delicate walk when you get older. You know, Ian Hunter did not have that. He was like striking the machine gun pose with the guitar and stuff. And he played for an hour and 45 minutes singing and playing guitar. And Adam, he sounded like 1976, and like it was one of the most amazing shows I've ever seen. Like I'm so happy. I feel so blessed that I got to see. I mean, I never thought that I would ever get to see Mott the Hoople. Nevertheless, Ian Hunter, and I got to see the remaining member of Mott the Hoople do an entire Mott the Hoople set, and I could not believe how fantastic he sounded. Plus, he's doing poses. He's strutting around at 79, Adam. It was insane.
Are you sure it wasn't one of those holograms?
It might have been. Like that's like he's 79. The only other person is Lee Scratch Perry, who's 83. He's doing like high kicks and stuff. But Lee Perry's a short guy, where Ian Hunter's really tall, and like he does not look 79. Some people are just superhuman, and Ian Hunter and Mott, the whole group sounded so they sounded better than the live CDs I had from the 70s. And I don't know. I think the tour might be over in the USA. They might be doing some England shows. But if you have a chance to go see Mott the Hoople, you need to go see it, because it blew my mind, Adley. Some shows you're like, wow, I'm so lucky. When I got to see Danzig do All Sam Hain, when I got to see one of the first Flag shows, when I got to see Melvins do 5 albums in a row, this Mott the Hoople show was right up there with it. They sounded so freakishly good. And it's like a lot of these punk kids are like, oh, I'm so old. Or a lot of these, Dropkick Murphys, they're kind of phoning it in at 45. Meanwhile, Ian Hunter, who was double the age of Dropkick Murphys, is coming out there and just slaying for an hour and 45 minutes, singing and playing guitar, and by the looks of it, having a lot of fun up there. I gotta say, if you're doing music at 79, you must be having fun. You know what I mean?
You know, for a bit that we've had going for a while, you are really committed to the fandom of this band that, I mean, kudos to you for sticking with it for so long. I can't believe that you actually, went to a show and pretended to like their music and
paid $100.
Paid $100. I mean, you are selling the fact that you are a fan of this band that no one actually knows anything about except that we like their name.
They were so good at it. They were. I don't know what else to say. It's somewhat inspiring and invigorating that you can be 79 and still kicking ass. Not a lot of people don't, and it's not anyone's fault. Some people just get old because of genetics or other reasons. But Ian Hunter just has never gotten old. Knock on wood.
Is he like a Jack LaLanne kind of thing? Like, is he like this like wiry old muscle man?
He's very skinny and he's very tall. And Lee Perry's very skinny, but he's very short.
Yeah, but you see, us short people are going to live forever. The tall ones, they have a problem. It's just like a giraffe, right? Like a giraffe isn't going to live that long because their heart has to pump blood more, to all these extremities, and it just has to work more. So if you're a tall creature, you inevitably are going to burn out before all of us little elves and dwarf people out here. So, I mean, he's got to have something going on to keep him kicking if he's a tall, old person. So it's either hologram or some sort of Peter Thiel virgin blood exchange.
Well, listen, whatever it takes, I say keep doing it. You know what I mean? Because if we get blessed with Ian Hunter for more years, I can't recommend it enough. And like I always say, see him while you can, appreciate him while you can. And Ian Hunter he's 79, Adam, and he sounds amazing. 79. And it's a rock and roll show. It's not like. And I'm not dissing Leonard Cohen. Leonard Cohen's cool. Leonard Cohen sits at the piano and sings kind of slowly. Ian Hunter is out there rocking out, Adam, for an hour 45 minutes at 79.
Whoa,
my grandparents definitely don't rock out. My freakishly young grandparents. So
I mean, a couple things. One, Leonard Cohen is dead, so he ain't doing anything. Two, we left out Vampire. And we left out Highlander, so he might be one of those things too.
I'm hoping it's Highlander. That because I mentioned Ian Hunter like beheading other musicians, and he's like, "I have the power." The weird thing about Highlander though is when you're a Highlander and you kill other Highlanders, you're supposed to get their powers, but it's never clear what that power is. Like Duncan MacLeod killed like 80 people, but he never seemed to increase in his sword fighting skill.
You know, I've never actually seen Highlander. It's one of those things that I only know from references to Highlander. Like
it's a good show.
Like it exists purely within the realm of like meme to me. It's I'm sure there's someone that like studies the way that information percolates through cultures, and that is something that is like someone's doctorate. Is like how everyone has this ambient awareness of certain things without actually having seen it or heard it or anything like that. Sort of like John, I've never actually listened to The Clash, right? But I can talk about it because everyone else is talking about it all the time. So I kind of got the gist of what's going on. Do we have any mail this week, John?
Yes, we do.
Let me tell you something about being old real quick before you get to the mail, because I am feeling so very old myself. I
Tom, last you got week, Ian Hunter's got double on you, so you don't get to feel old.
Well, yet. I missed you guys so much last week. You know, obviously, I thought we should see each other twice this week, so that's nice. But I was on vacation with my family last week for a little rest and relaxation in the sun. It was my kids' spring break from school, and I came back and I am more tired than before I left. And I've grown this. I haven't shaved since I've been gone, and I've sort of grown this weird combination of like what you might call a playoff beard or a depression beard. And I'm about 1 week away from starting to wear Kleenex boxes on my feet and shuffling around with my robe gently falling open for all the neighbors to see. But I'm glad that Mata Hoopla is good.
Are you exhausted because you had to keep up with your younglings, or are you exhausted because you partied so hard at spring break that you didn't sleep for a week?
I did have some good adult company, so we did. We did definitely. I didn't live the way I do at home. I definitely attacked life with a little more vigor. My kids aren't so little anymore. You know, they don't need so much chasing around. But it's just that's vacation when you have kids. You end up more tired than before you went on vacation. You're like, man, I'm so glad I'm back to work so that I can relax.
Yeah,
even though I'm currently on call for my job, and that's why I was just on the phone a minute ago, and so I'm. Like, that's a 24-hour day thing, so that tends to whoop my ass, too. So
Tom, are you an assassin?
What's that? Yes.
Are you an assassin?
No. Judging from his ringtone, he is an ice cream man.
We need ice cream quick.
You know, I used to have Blitzkrieg Bop as my ringtone, but I got this newer phone, and I never bothered to put a custom ringtone. So, yes, I'm choosing from the various lame, like, built-in ringtones. I admit it. It's a grandma ringtone.
Well, speaking of Tom and him delivering ice cream throughout the neighborhood, this is from Jillian says, I love Tom Trauma. He's the most likable person on the podcast. Tom, hello. And that's from Jillian.
Well, hi, Jillian. Thank you. That's very nice.
Wow. Thanks, Jillian.
I hate for you to insult these other jerks, but since you did anyway, no. Thanks, Jillian. I appreciate it.
This is from George 17.
George 17. Tom is a total asshole. He's the only one I can't stand on the podcast.
It's been years since you guys have fought with another band, label, or management. Where's the fire? You've gotten soft punk news. I say randomly pick a band with some dice and get at them.
Mata Hoople. That's they're my sights.
From George 17.
Some young spry guys, 80-year-old guys.
I feel like we've been trying to pick a fight of indifference with Rise Records for just because we don't understand it. Yeah, who's the enemy right now? I'm not sure who the enemy is.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I remember I was John. You were a Howard Stern fan or no?
Yeah, I am a fan. I don't
listen to him anymore, but I was a huge fan. But people used to say that to him. Oh, you've gone to Hollywood, you know, because he used to just tear on all celebrities. But he, you know, the same thing happens to guys like us. You know, it's like, oh, we love to rip on bands, but eventually you get to know so many people, and then you know people who know people, and you just don't really want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know. So you just kind of don't be so vicious.
That is a part of it, but I think another part of it is, I mean, to a degree, the war is over and we won, and that a lot of the competition has fallen by the wayside. I mean, we used to battle with some other websites and other magazines, and other magazines used to take out hit pieces on us. And they were all like, oh, we do our part, or we're the true underground punk rockers. Oh, yeah, but we'll take advertisements and you can pay us directly. They're all gone away and we're still kicking along.
It is funny. I accidentally stumbled across a very derisive piece from Razor Cake about the whole Buzz Media thing but it was like 2011. It was along or whatever year it was. But yeah, it was definitely.
I'll beef with Razor Cake right now because a couple years ago, they went and they took all of their punk news hit pieces and like published it as a single zine that you can buy.
Really? I bought it.
Like, now on the one hand, on the one hand, that is a certain point of pride in my life in that, I personally am the subject of a like Razor Cake hit piece. Like that means I was doing something.
Well, I saw that you were definitely quoted in this piece, that I read. Definitely being the sort of company guy sort of dancing around. It was good. It was good stuff.
I know. But part of my, here's the thing that I, that makes me happy though, is that if I recall that article at the time, or that whole series of articles that they published at the time. And so this was back when for the listener that doesn't know what we're talking about, A handful of years ago, like five, no, more than five, like 10 years
probably
ago.
Like 7 or 8, something like that, yeah.
A bunch of years ago, Aubin, who's the guy that owns Punk News, was working for a company called Buzz Media, which was then became Spin Media, which said, I don't know. He was working in some sort of like, I don't even know what he was doing for them because we don't talk, but he was working for this company.
Hitman.
He was a hitman for Buzz Media. He was doing some sort of like internet music stuff with them. And part of what their business was like they sold ads for sites. So they did like in the same way that like you can go if you have a website and you want like Google to put banner ads on your site. Well, the Buzz's product offering would do that. So and they had a whole portfolio of sites that were like part of the Buzz Media family that they had legitimately bought. But Aubin worked for them. So that he had some sort of deal, which was like, they'll sell our ads. So instead of us selling our ads or Google selling our ads, that's what they did for a while. And then that became this like, but then we were listed as like part of their like portfolio of sites on which you could buy ads, which was true because we were. But the way that it was all labeled was in this like Buzz was never too concerned with our branding. So it really looked like if you came at it from a certain angle that like we were one of the Buzz Media properties, which, you know, was news to all of us because we, you know, we were all just doing what we had been doing for the past 10 years. And Aubin, I love the guy, but like he to a fault is a private person. So he didn't decide that this was anything that he needed to get out there and clear up or talk about or anything like that. And, you know, this was his job.
So it fell on your shoulders.
Well, but also it was his job. So I wasn't going to go like speak for him in that capacity until, you know, push comes to shove. And I had to speak for him. And then look what I got for my trouble is I'm the fucking apologist in this article. But one of the things that was this article, either the one that I was in particular or the whole series was called like Punk News is infotainment or something like that, right? And one of the authors of this series of Let's Take Down Punk News hit pieces is someone that in a later life became Dan Ozzie, who writes for Noisy. And I just want to say, I mean, Dan has actually done like a lot of really good work for a lot of bands that I like. So I don't want to shit on his job or anything like that. But buddy, you write infotainment articles now. So what the fuck?
Meanwhile, is Buzz Media even still a thing?
They fought for bad.
Yeah, see, because Punk News is still a thing.
Yeah, they bought a bunch of things. They bought when that company was Buzz, I didn't even know what they owned. They owned like a bunch of gossip magazines, like TMZ style things. And then they bought Spin, like Spin the magazine Spin, and like a couple hip hop magazines that were really big that I forget which. But I don't know. It was one of these venture capital funded internet companies that I don't think had, you know, that acquired more things than they actually had a viable business plan to do anything about.
One thing that I do want to add is not so much anymore, but 3 or 4 years ago, I would hear people say, hey, Punk News sold out to Spin, or doesn't Spin still own you guys? The answer is no. And it's easy to prove it. Go to Spin Media's bankruptcy filing, and Punk News is not listed as an asset. You know what I mean? If you don't believe us, you know, so there you go. So anyways, that you can always reach that podcast.
Well, I don't know who does our advertising now, but I'd just like to say thank you, because how else would I know that there's young Asian women near me that are looking to meet, or horny single mothers near me?
Tom, I hate to tell you, but the ads are just giving you what you want.
I know it. I wonder what I've been clicking on to.
Yeah, my ads are all Mata Hoople.
Yeah, actually, yeah, here's
John's ads are all these emaciated 79-year-old men with Fu Manchus. I don't know.
Since we're talking about how things work, I want to talk about ads just for a sec, just to clear this up, because every once in a while I'll get someone that'll email me this, and I don't know what to do about it. So I think all the ads that are on Punk News.
I have to stop being pervy.
Yeah. All the ads that are on punknews.org right now are just Google ads. And if you know, like, if you've done any work on the internet for like 10 minutes, you have enough knowledge to implement the Google ads on your site. It's like you sign up for an account, they give you some code, and you paste it where you want the ad to go. It's like embedding a YouTube video in terms of complication. You can do more shit than that, but that's sort of the long and short of how it works. And that's how Punk News' ads work. And if you'll notice, like, they're just those stock Google ads that just fill in with like Asian singles or whatever things they just fill in with, because we're not actually actively out there trying to sell ads to people or trying to get, like, you know, trying to get bands or labels or people that are pushing something about punk music to actually come buy ads. And this is because this isn't a business for anyone, and that's work. Like, we used to do that. Aubin used to do that way back in the day. But the problem was that, like, you had to collect. So if, you know, you went and sold, you know, a bunch of banner ads based in Narma Records for the month, well, that means then you had to go, like, chase Narma Records to pay you. And believe it or not, getting a bunch of punk dudes to pay you on time is not something...
We all know Narma Records has a lot of collection issues.
Yeah. so at some
point... Definitely shady company.
So like,
ads, they're like the new Rise Records.
Yeah, like, ads on the internet, especially for a site our size, like, the bottom fell out on that market in, like, 2002. So, you know, when the bubble burst, when the internet bubble burst...
Was, like, it that long ago?
Yeah, because there was... Well, 2002, might be 2004... Because I was in university from 2000 to 2001 until 2001 to 2005. And when I was in, like, third or fourth year of school, like, I seriously, like, went up and sat down with Aubin at one point, and I was like, okay, I'm going to graduate soon. Like, let's open up the fucking Punk News office.
How am I going to make a living out of Punk News?
Well, no, but we sat down at one point and we're like, okay, let's work out the, how do we pay people plan? And it wasn't a matter of, like, it, you know, it, could we pay people? It was like, no, like, we could totally pay people. You know, we just need to come up with, like, how we, you know,
so the checks in the mail, Adam?
Like, what's an article worth kind of thing. And then, like, then the bubble burst, right? Like, all that, like, pets.com fiasco, like all the money sucked out of it, and whatever, like, limped out afterwards as the internet ad market doesn't actually make any money. So there you go. The fucking early internet bubble is what made Punk News not a real thing. But I still get emails from people to me that are like, hi, I'd like to, you know, we're some Italian label, and we have some Ramones core band coming out. We'd like to buy a banner ad on Punk News. And I was like, A, don't do that. But B, why are you asking me? And, like, they're always asking me, John. And no matter how much I make it so that I am not the owner of the site, because I am not the owner of the site, they're always asking me.
Tell them to send checks to Narma Records, and Narma Records will be sure that you get your ad listed on the website.
It's funny. Like, once in a while, when we get a Snow News Week, maybe we should just do this, where we sort of, like, show the making of the sausage, because I'm sort of interested by this stuff as someone who only gets to see a little bit of the, you know, I, like, maybe I'm in charge of the casings, you know?
Here's how
punk, and maybe somebody else is in charge of the, you know, the actual grinding of the meat, and, you know, at the end of the day, we have a beautiful sausage. But, you know, I don't get to see every piece of it.
John grinds the meat. He's covered in fucking meat at the end of the day. No one cares. Wear
gloves, his commenters are
yelling at you. John emerges from the Punk News butchery just, like, dripping in gristle and shit, and everyone's like, "Fuck you, John!" as they eat the delicious sausage John made. That's what happens.
You know what? Maybe that's a bad idea anyway, because I sort of like this idea sometimes that people think we're a bigger, more professional organization than what we are, because I think it's been around so long and it has such a,
I mean, I get
you know, I think people overestimate what we are.
Oh, like, I'll get emails from someone, and I'm sure everyone gets these, and they're just form emails, but sometimes they seem a little bit more sincere than that, where it's like, "Hey, Adam, I'm this publicist. How much of your crew is going to be at South by Southwest this year? We should meet up," or something. I'm like, what are you talking about?
We already used our travel budget for this year.
Yeah, like, are you so,
when I drove to the post office,
like, fuck.
Hey, it's great though. It's great. I love it.
Adam, thank you for the appreciation. Oh, I do appreciate that. And it's true, man. Punk News is, it's the answer is, it's chaos, and somehow things fall into place usually, but not always. Before we get to the news proper, let's just touch on this briefly. As we have done for the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, we did an April Fool's article. Our April Fool's article was kind of simple and understated this year, not a gigantic production like we have done in the past. In the past, we did the whole, Masked Intruder robs a whole bunch of different bands, which I thought was kind of funny. We did a whole bunch of joke articles. There was one other theme one we did that I can't remember what it was. One time I interviewed Dale Nixon of Black Flag for April Fool's. But this time we just did Punk News to Reissue First Review to celebrate 20th anniversary. And much to my surprise, I thought the last 3 or 4 years of April Fool's have been pure hatred. Instead, it was pure laughter. And I thought this one was inoffensive and perhaps somewhat mediocre and safe, but I did want to continue the tradition of April Fools. Why was this one generally well received, and should we keep doing April Fools? I like doing the April Fools, but it seems like everyone else on the internet is like sick of it, but I just think people are haters and not fun. And I love
think it's
people.
Fun, but we almost always end up getting unforeseen backlash. For some reason, we're almost blinded to what people might perceive it as. But I'm down with it. I was too busy this year to really help with the brainstorming process much, but I think it's fun. I'd like to continue the tradition.
Did you think this year was weaker? I thought it was kind of weak, but I mean,
it was small. It was a smaller scale thing.
Okay. If we want to come back to the theme of when people want to buy ads for some reason, they ask Adam White. When people want to yell at Punk News for shit that they're offended about and shouldn't be, they yell at me. So the one April Fool's backlash, which we shall not talk about too much because it will surely come back to bite me in the ass. I was basically like, you know, I had like a one finger left in the door at that point. I was like today sucks so much. Who is not worth it for me to just take this bullshit for something that I'm not getting paid for. Like, fuck it, I'm out. Like, I was so out after that. So my opinion on the whole, you know, should we keep April Fools in around is pretty colored by that. However, John,
it's been quite a few years now, Adam.
Yeah, I know.
Time to let it slide.
But when I saw John, when I saw your article, and it was this gentle little. You know, goofing on us, obvious April Fool's thing, and it wasn't a giant production and everything like that. My heart just sang, John. I was like, I was just a Twitter. I'm like, this is the inoffensive, you know, middle of the road, mushy bullshit that I want from the things that I am potentially responsible for. This is great. I'm down with this inoffensive, you know, phoning it in April Fool's thing that we did. Fantastic.
I've already got my article for next year. I gotta write that down before I forget. It just struck me.
Well, people did enjoy the Dave Grohl zinger, which I appreciated. They appreciated that. I will say the zinger was being also a documentary on the review will accompany the reissue and will feature interviews with Dave Grohl, Ian MacKay, Henry Rollins, Thurston Moore, and Dave Grohl again. So I thought that was an all right joke. All right, let's play a song. Let's stop patting ourselves on the back and let's do what we came here to do, which is criticize other people and tell hardworking
start fights with other bands and
how they could have done a better job than what they did. Let's see who's got a song. I've got a song if anyone else has a song. Otherwise, I will go later on.
I got a song whenever too. Whatever you want to do. Off,
Tom. What do we got? What do we got?
So I got another song from. Regular Punk News podcast contributor Liverpool Neil. He sent me this MP3 for a 77 British punk band that I actually had never heard of, called the Neon Hearts.
Never heard of them.
And this is a pretty cool little song. It's called Regulations. I dig it. Keep them coming, Neil.
Regulations, 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 reg
And that was Neon Hearts from Liverpool. Neil, let's break into the news. And speaking of inoffensive things that really don't cause anyone to get that upset, Jawbreaker's writing new material. They were very careful to say that they're not recording new material.
That's very offensive, Jazz.
But they are writing
a multitude of Jawbreaker lovers on this site.
They are writing new material, and they are also resurrecting some never recorded songs, but some songs that were played live or at least demoed from back in the day. People were all very excited. People love Jawbreaker. I just don't get the Jawbreaker thing, but people love them. Here's the question I think I would focus on. Comeback albums. 7 out of 10 times they're complete failures. 2 out of 10 times they're okay. And 1 out of 10 times they're like actually worthwhile. You know, is this the right move for Jawbreaker to be taking? Or should they be doing the Misfits thing? One show every 6 months and you can come see us at a festival and we'll make lots of money. But it's not our main thing these days.
The fact that they're doing some old songs might be the saving grace. I'm with you. Yeah. I'm not a Jawbreaker enthusiast.
I in my youth I partook of Jawbreaker on the sneak, but I did it after everyone had already sort of canonized them and lost their shit. Like Jawbreaker is one of those bands that when I started writing for Punk News, just they weren't part of my personal experience with punk rock, but they were clearly everyone else's. So I had to go back after the fact and find out like, oh, why does everyone love this band? And I had to consume their stuff in a way that like basically mashed all of the history and drama or whatever that was involved in it into like one, you know, 2 hour listening session. And that I'm sure robs it of a lot of like what made it meaningful for people. So like there was a few of those bands when I came on. Jawbreaker was one. Kid Dynamite was another one. Which is like I knew of them, like I knew the name, but when I got on here and started talking, like hanging out with people like Scott Heisel and them, and then realizing that like no, this isn't just like some band that some people might be a fan of. This band is like the cornerstone of the lives of like a whole section of the youth. And while I was out there, you know, listening to Slackers records, people were doing the Jawbreaker thing. So I had to go sit down and like consume their whole catalog in an afternoon to know what I was talking about. And I'm sure that lessened like whatever impact that they were supposed to have. So while I really like a lot of the stuff on say like 24 Hour Revenge Therapy, and I can get behind a lot of the stuff that's on Dear You, I didn't experience those records with, you know, time and anticipation and all that. So the fact that Dear You was so produced and so wrapped up in the major label drama and, you know, and all of this, you know, had no impact on me. I'm just like, oh, this is a cleaner sounding record. And their earlier stuff that a lot of people, I think, retreated into and really, you know, really started to love this, and like reevaluate all the early raw recordings that they had. You know, I just listen to them and go like, oh, this stuff sounds like shit compared to the later stuff. And so like all the emotional impact of that band's history, like was lost on me. So my interaction with them now, it's just like, oh, they're back. I would go see them if they were playing in a town near me, but I'm not going to go get on I'm not going to fly across country to go to one of their last shows. Like I could take it or leave it, you know, whatever. And I feel that that is not the common punk news Jawbreaker experience. So yeah, we're the wrong group of people to get super stoked. Well, there's ghosts happening. We're the wrong group of people to get really excited about this and to comment too much on it. But I agree with Tom for sure. If a band is going to, I'm always curious when a band, you know, pulls some proto song that never got recorded, you know, out of the past and does something new with it. I always feel like that's a little bit of a line, and it's that, and that's probably more true of all songwriting, is that, you know, you always have bits and pieces that you pick up and put down over the career of a band. But whenever I hear that, I'm somehow more interested in what they're doing than if it was just, you know, them sitting down to write a bunch of like brand new shit.
Well, see, sometimes that's like the junk that wasn't that good to begin with, so they never finished it. You know, like if Jumpin' Jack Flash jumps into your brain, you're not like, oh, I'll put this down for a while. You're like, I got to figure out the song right now because the song's amazing, you know?
Well, there's a podcaster that I listen to who's a musician, and he's always talking about the fact that, you know, his main like storage of song ideas at this point in his life is his phone. So he'll just be like wandering around his house with a guitar, and like all of a sudden you'll get some chunk of a lick in your head that might be a song. So wherever the hell you are, you know, you plug in your phone and you record in, you know, a few bars of whatever you were just knocking around. And then you do that for a while. And then at the end of the year, you've got like, you know, 190 pieces of songs, you know, sitting there that you could do something with. So there's that aspect to it where, yeah, there's a lot of bits and pieces all the time that are floating around. And, you know, it's interesting to like look at the process and see how that stuff gets used. But I don't know. I feel like bands say that a lot, but it's.
John, should I put this into a Danzig context or a Metallica context?
Danzig, Metallica.
Okay, here's the Danzig context. Do you? I'm sure you have this. Any true fan would have this.
Oh,
the Lost Tracks of Danzig. The tracks with the original band are so great.
Very true.
Like the original, like early '90s stuff is so good, and the rest of it, later stuff, was like, eh. So I think there's something to that. The old song. I say the Metallica analogy was going to be, this was just compared to what Adam was just saying. The reason that Metallica said their last album was so lackluster was because Kirk Hammett, I guess, like had all his riffs in his phone. Like whenever he was working on a riff, he'd put it in his phone, and then he lost his phone, and they had to make the record, and he didn't have all his riffs. That's why they were saying the last album.
Metal bands take forever to write music. And
some of them do.
Like, oh, we were working on these riffs for 7 years. Like, don't you write a riff in like 3 minutes? Isn't it like, there's your riff. You know, I just wrote a riff. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
are you Lemmy? Are you Lemmy? Or are you more pretentious than Lemmy? You know what I mean? Like, because Lemmy could do that. And there are bands that can do it. You know, Overkill puts out an album about every 2 years. And it's awesome. And they're full of riffs and they thrash and they're great. So it's you know, it can be done, but. I think it depends how hungry you are. You look at like Metallica, like, you know, what is their lifestyle, John? I mean, they're rich as the Pope. I mean, they don't need to crank out riffs. It's just not that big of a priority.
So you think when they say, oh, we were working on these riffs for 7 years, they weren't really working on the riffs?
They get up at 10 o'clock, are massaged by nude women, you know, and drink gold champagne with gold flecks in it. And, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon for 15 minutes, they pick up their guitars. Yes.
Well, speaking of a band that cranks out 2 to 3 albums a year, the Melvins are working on a new release. With
there's a guy who can write a riff, King Bozo, man.
He writes many, many riffs each year. They are recording an album with Flipper, or maybe not. Who knows? It's either an album or an EP. It's definitely at least an EP, but maybe it will be a full album. It's Melvins and Flipper. Of course, Flipper is kind of in a state of discombobulation right now with David Yao on vocals. Bruce Luce is pretty much retired from music. So it's Ted Falcone, David Yao, and some other guys in Flipper, and the Melvins are Dale Crover and Buzz Osborne. And
I mean, it's Ted Falcone, that basically, and whoever, right?
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, this is very exciting. But one of the, I guess, frustrating things about, if you ask me, Melvins are still in their prime. But when two groups often do super group, like meld togethers, it's often like at the end of the band's career. Like blues guys would do that, like in the 80s or 90s, like BB King and Muddy Waters would be dead. BB King and Howlin' Wolf. It's like that's cool that you're doing it in 1987, but would have been really cool if you did it in 1966. And the other thing though is like when groups do supergroup connections, like a lot of times it's not that good. A la Lou Reed and Metallica, or another example. Another, I guess, more applicable example would be I think Adam did not like the what was that band? It was like King Khan and the Black Lips, and they were like satanic or something.
Oh, it was Almighty Defenders.
Yeah, yeah. See, a lot of his recordings often just feel kind of tossed off. Or another great example would be Ty Segall did an album with the other the other guy, I can't remember. Anyway, a lot of those recordings often feel like they're not really that important. They're just kind of throwaways. So are you excited when there's a supergroup mashup, or is it, you know, often disappointing because neither band is really super committed to it because they want to do their own thing on their own, not with someone else? That being said, I'm very excited for this. Melvins do not do throwaway stuff. Like, every Melvins thing counts, and they're mega Flipper fans, so I'm very excited for this.
I dig Flipper, but Flipper's kind of one of those bands that, you know, they did that generic album in what, like 1983?
I think it was 82. Because I think the second album is 83.
But they never really were able to follow it up with something.
Oh, I like the second album better, honestly. It's got Sacrifice on it. I really do like it.
What's that one called?
The second one is called, like, The Sound and the Light. I think it's got Sacrifice on it, which is my favorite Flipper song by far.
Okay. I have I have Blowin' Chunks, the live album, and I have the generic album. I'd have to see which ones. I can't remember what all I have. I have something with Sacrifice on it.
A generic Flipper is 82. Gone Fishing is 84.
Okay. I might have a compilation or something that has Sacrifice on it. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I'm curious. I'm curious to hear this more than I am a lot of your Melvins related stuff.
I was going to say, speaking of 1984, Crass is reissuing the Best Before 1984, and they're going to repress the Crassical collection here. So here we go. So they just recently released a digital remaster of the Best Before 1984 comp, and today details of a physical version of surfaced, today being 6 days ago when the story was written. The new version, it's coming out via Crass Records, and it's going to be distributed by One Little Indian Records. It appears that the re-release is not part of the Crassical collection set of releases, which had slightly modified some of the original albums and added bonus tracks and things like that. So it's unclear if the physical re-release is going to have a slightly altered track listing like the digital re-release had or not. The vinyl version of the remastered Best Before 1984 is out right now. Tom, ice cream needs you.
Dang it. All right, just a second, guys. Keep going.
We're going.
He's got to go assassinate somebody else.
And the CD version of Best Before 1984 is out on May 17th. So meanwhile, the Crassical collection itself went out of print almost immediately after its initial release. And Crass Records / One Little Indian has also repressed that series. John, I just read your story here. I did not understand a word of it. What should people take from this?
It's because the press release was so jumbled. Here's what's actually happening. I'm going to flex my... Adam, should I or should I not flex my punk cred?
Flex away.
I was speaking with Penny Rimbaud about this. Here's what's happening, and the press release was terribly written. Crass is reissuing their original. So there's the Crass discography and the Crassical collection. The Crassical collection was the major remaster update of the Clash discography in 2010. It basically was the same as the original material, except for there was slightly altered track releases, and the albums had new cover art and new information. So they were sort of like mega deluxe reissues, and they were exceptionally well done. Crass fans hating change, despite the fact that Crass is all about change, they didn't. Some people loved it, some people didn't love it. So just now, Crass is re-releasing two sets of the Crass discography. One set is a brand new remastered series of the original recordings on CD and record. So what we would say is a traditional remaster. That is, they took the original source recordings, and by they, I mean Penny Rimbaud himself, remastered the entire Crass series, and they're going to reissue, you know, Feeding the 5,000, Stations of the Crass, Christ the Album, Penis Envy, Yes Sir I Will, and 10 Notes on a Summer's Day, as they were in 1977 through 1984, except for with remastered sound. The Best Before 1984 compilation is also part of that reissue series. Meanwhile, now I put that aside. Meanwhile, Penny Rimbaud, who is extremely proud of the Crassical collection, has also done some minor tweaking to the Crassical collection, and they are re-releasing that as well. The 2019 Crassical collection is nearly identical to the 2010 version, with a few minor tweaks here and there, and I think one or two track changes. And there will also be a classical collection of Best Before 1984 to fit in line with the classical collection series, which does have an altered track list as the digitally released version from about a month ago now. So does that make any sense, Adam?
What?
and the more interesting thing is here is what label is this out on? It is not out on Southern Records, the label that has traditionally released all Crash material and was headed by John Loder. Instead, it's out on One Little Indian Records. And of course, Adam, who is One Little Indian Records? You might not know.
I don't.
That's Flux of Pink Indians, which quite surprisingly started their own record label and became a gigantic record label that has put out major label stuff. Well, in England, they almost are major label. They put out stuff by like Bjork and like all that kind of stuff, as well as Chumbawamba and mega hits Chumbawamba and all that kind of stuff. So why is it not on Southern Records? And I don't think I'm talking out of school here, but after John Loder passed away, Southern Records was shuffled between 2 to 3 people. And I believe Southern Records technically owned the Crass's stuff, or somehow they had like an exclusive licensing deal or something like that, as they did with Rudimentary P&I and other stuff. And unfortunately, and quite sadly, it's somewhat of a – well, it's sad in that – how do you have the Crass discography and the Rudimentary P&I discography and reissue the majority of those catalogs and screw it up? So you really have to have severe mismanagement, Adam, to blow reissuing Crass and Rudimentary P&I. I mean, that essentially sells itself, doesn't it? I would think. Maybe it doesn't.
You would think, but I'm never sure. I'm never sure what the market is for Crass. Like it always feels like it is a band that has the credibility and has the history behind it, but like I don't know if it has the hordes lining up to buy in the same way that your Ramoneses and things have. I mean, of course they don't, but just I'm never sure.
Yeah. Well, anyways, so that's a striking thing to point out, that it is now on One Little Indian, no longer Southern. And it appears that Southern might actually be defunct because they haven't updated their website in like a year and a half. And they got halfway through Rudimentary P&I and choked to a stop. And I'm excited this stuff is coming out. I'm probably going to buy both sets just because I'm a Crass maniac. And this is looking cool, so I'm excited for this.
I'm back, at least temporarily.
Tom, you played your song, right?
I did.
You did. Okay, good. See if you don't have to get that out in case you have to run. I'm going to go next then. All right. So there is this this proto-punkish sounding group out of Toronto called Protruders. They've been described as like neo-proto-punk, in that they're taking a lot of these early sounds and kind of cranking them up and recontextualizing them and playing them with a new modern spin. I like them because they're just one of these bands that is just like awesome lo-fi noise, and they're great live. So they have a record coming out. It's their first actual LP after a bunch of cassettes that they've put out. It's called Poison Future. It's coming out on April 20th from a Virginia label called Feel It Records. And I think you can stream the whole thing on Bandcamp right now, but I had heard one song from it earlier and I was really stoked. This band has it has members of a bunch of other bands that I like, but I feel like they don't want this necessarily out there in the world because they're trying to be, cool and anonymous, or maybe they're just trying to cross the border. I don't know how it works. So in any case, I'm going to play a song from this upcoming record. It is called Hydrophotal. That's how it's pronounced. It is described in the press release, in the write-up for this record as, and this is a very you description here, because they say that this song has some skronky sax that gives it kind of a Hawkwind / No Wave feel. So there you go. Hawkwind was mentioned. I thought I'd bring that to your attention. Anyways, Protruders is awesome. This song is called Hydrophotal. It's from the record, which is Poison Future. It is probably, it's out in what, 10 days? It's out in 10 days on Feel It Records. You should get a copy. I got a chemical.
And that was Protruders, one of Adam White's new favorite bands. And let's talk about another one of Adam White's favorite bands, Green Day. They're putting out a book that no one asked for. The book is called Last of the American Girls, and it is described as an inspiring homage and handbook for the rebellious every woman who refuses to capitulate. And that was described by Day Street Books. It's at October 29, and it was written by Green Day, as well as the writer Frank Caruso. Here's what Billy Joe Armstrong said about the book. Then I started getting into more of my own beliefs, anything from a little book of conspiracies to playing vinyl records or something. It's sort of about empowering, sort of about subterranean kind of lifestyle. But at the same time, there's a new era coming in the way that we all need to live. I will say Green Day took mega smacks all over the internet for four guys writing the quote handbook for the rebellion
for women. Yes.
I'm not a huge Green Day fan. I'm certainly not a hater, but I'm not a huge fan. I did feel somewhat bad for them because that quote is the quote from the marketing arm of their publisher. And I don't even know if they ran that past the band. Like, the band probably didn't sit down and said, we're going to write a book for the rebellious every woman. This is probably just some guy in the marketing chain down the line, and it kind of blew up and may have ruined the campaign. Not that I'm saying this would be a good book, but I'm not exactly sure the marketing quote is what Green Day intended to be the main takeaway from this book.
Well, on that note, guys, I as much as I'd love to talk about the new Green Day book for rebellious women, I do have to go. So it's been fun. Next week, I won't be on call. I won't run out on you, and I will talk to you then. So thank you, people, and Adam and John and loyal listeners and blah, blah, blah. I must go attend to some municipal emergencies. So anyway, guys, I'll see you tomorrow or later. Or someday. I'll see you someday. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Adam, can we speculate as to what Tom does that he has to run out at 10:41 in the evening?
Oh, I can speculate because I have had people in my life that worked for cities, and their frequent this time of year thing that they had to do was run out because there was like a frozen pipe or a water main broke. So that is my guess.
I want to imagine that he's some kind of like international, like robber/hacker, like he's breaking into like ultra top secret like security places and like downloading data and like bringing it back to Lansing or wherever, or Grand Rapids.
He could be doing that thing, that stuff too. But I mean, so that person that wrote in that was like, oh, I love Tom, he's the best person on the show. Well, Tom has abandoned you now. So
yeah,
think about that.
And we're still here.
Yeah.
And you're going to come back crying to us.
Just delete the rest of the show because it's over. Is it over, John? What else do we have to talk about? What's going on?
You don't care about this book?
Oh, this Green Day book thing. Jesus, yeah. I was so engaged with this Green Day book that I forgot that I'm supposed to have an opinion on it.
First of all, Adam, like how did Green Day get it in their brains? You know, we should write a book. That's what we should like. That's already getting off on the wrong foot. You know what I mean?
I'm always suspicious when a group of people write a book in the sense that like, what does it mean that Green Day wrote a book? They mean that like Billy Joe is a co-author of this book with the person who seems like they're the, you know, like the writer illustrator that seems like they're probably the one that like, this is their trade and that they make books. You know, or did they all sit down and collaboratively as a group of four, you know, put their minds to what's going on here? I mean, none of that is impossible, but it always seems like maybe that's more marketing than reality when you see something like that. This has been so colored by the weird internet reaction to it and the fact that it does seem like you know, like it's four guys trying to write something that is meant to be empowering for young girls. That I can't quite see past that. To me, it's a little bit weird that like that's the slant that they took on it, because they could totally go write a piece of fiction that has a female protagonist in it, or a non-cis protagonist in it, or whatever. And just have that be who the character is. And I don't think that would raise anyone's alarms or anything. But the fact that this has been billed as The Handbook for the Rebellious Every Woman. That is in the label. Maybe it seems like there's some, at least on the marketing end, some ill-conceived notions going into this thing.
As to how is this written, I think I don't believe that Green Day got together and said, we should write a book. I could be wrong. I would say Day Books came to Green Day, says, do you want to write a book with our in-house guy? And they were like, yeah, we do. So then the guy comes up with like an outline, and then they give it to Green Day, and then the members of Green Day say, oh, here are our thoughts. And then the guy writes it, and therefore it's co-authored by Green Day. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think all four of them were sitting in a room with cigarettes around a single computer, looking over the guy's shoulder while he's typing it out, you know? I will say it is a Green Day got famous in the 90s, and this seemed to be a very 90s thing in that, like, three punk pop punk dudes write a book or a song about a cool punk rock chick, you know, that they'd want to hang out with. And that's what that seems like to me. You know, it's just unnecessary, and I think Green Day could have played their hand a little bit better. That being said, and we'll cover one last topic and not to drag this out. Adam, it is amazing that Green Day still does basically represent a youthful voice. I went and I saw the Beastie Boys sing last Friday, I think it was. It was awesome. Adam, everybody, I was the youngest guy there. Everybody was like 40, 45, 50 at the Beastie Boys thing. Green Day's fans are still 14, 15, 16, 17. Look at it this way. Green Day's been a band for what, 30 years now? Let's see, 86 to 96? 32 years, right? If Green Day were the Rolling Stones, it would be 1994, Voodoo Lounge. So it's astounding that Green Day is still the youth voice. You know what I mean?
I feel like that's bad. I feel that they had a growth trajectory at some point, and then they decided to double back. Because like I was a huge fan of Warning, which was the record that they released. Was it 2000? Was Warning came out? And this was a record that saw them really, really becoming a guitar pop band. And there was just like a lot of like they shed a lot of the punkiness on that and wrote these songs that in my mind were beautifully written pop songs. Just like big, just gorgeous power pop songs that are on that thing. And I was listening to Warning and thinking like, oh, okay, like this is the direction, right? Like you can't be, you know, scrappy singing about, you know, masturbation and smoking weed, you know, teenage band anymore. So you're going to use the fact that you're all pretty accomplished musicians at this point to go and just like explore that space, right? And you could totally see could you not see a future for Green Day, let's say a potential future for Green Day where it's say 2000 and, you know, they release one or two of these like big lush pop records. And then Billy Joe goes off and he's Paul Weller, right? Where he's moving on from his punk rock roots to go establish this really unique sounding solo career that doesn't feel like it needs to, you know, sound like it's full of his teenage, you know, rage anymore. Like I could see that as a path for him, but that's not what they did. They went and they wrote like a bunch of rock operas about teenaged angst. And one of them landed, and it landed in a way that all of a sudden, you know, all 16-year-olds were listening to him again. And all of us that were 16 the first time around, we're kind of just like sitting there chewing on it and going like, I guess there's some fun songs on American Idiot, I guess, but this is not what I wanted, Green Day. This is not what Warning promised us. So yeah, it's strange to me that they were on that trajectory and then they doubled down on the 16-year-olds.
It worked out financially.
But speaking of things, it's amazing because those records were arguably, probably sales wise, bigger than the 90s stuff. And it's just, but it's such a different, it just feels like such a different, don't know if it's like a different band, but it's like just like from a different universe. It's you know, it's Spock with a beard, right? Like it's this weird bizarro version of the band that I still feel like I don't recognize. There was someone, I was taking my kid to swimming lessons the other day, and some mom walked by with her kid, and she was wearing a Green Day shirt from the American Idiot and After era, and everything about it, the just like the typography and the imagery and all that, it could have been a My Chemical Romance shirt. And just like how much it had leaned into just that, or like that early 2000s era of music that just wasn't my era. And how, if I was to see someone come by with like a Lookout era Green Day shirt on, I'd be like, this is a totally different band. These two people do not like hang out together. They exist on totally different, you know, phases of reality. So yeah, the Green Day thing stumps me. Because I kind of want to be a fan of all the stuff that was big when I was a kid, but I almost feel like I feel embarrassed by it a little bit now, not by that music, but just by attesting to be a modern day Green Day fan. Like, cause I'm not on board with where they went.
Well, speaking of weird bizarro versions, Holo Dio rises from the grave once again. Dio, that is the hologram version of Dio, Holo Dio, is going on tour this summer for a fairly extended tour, May through the end of June. He's going to be backed by his actual live band with a couple of new people, and there's going to be some guest spots. Tim Owens of Judas Priest, but not really Judas Priest, and some other bands, and Oni Logan, who I think was in like some 80s band, not Dokken, but some band like Dokken. The show will be about 90 minutes long, and it's going to be playing Rainbow, Black Sabbath, and Dio tracks. Adam, I thought this fad was going to die out and that no one would care, but we got Holo Roy this summer, Holo Buddy, Holo Dio, the Holo Rage. People want Holos, Adam. People are dying for the Holos.
The fact that you're not saying Holo is really bugging me right now, and I hope it's bugging Holo? Your listeners. Yeah.
Holo?
If you think John can't pronounce that word, please write
hologram.
Podcast.
Hologram. It's not a hologram. It's hologram.
No, it's hologram.
Hologram.
Yeah.
Oh, but Holo Dio is funnier. Holo Dio is not funny. Holo Dio is funny.
I maintain that the people making these holograms are not taking full advantage of the art form. I don't want to see a... 5'6" hologram version of Dio on stage with a bunch of with people that are in a band playing music. I want to see a 50-foot Dio, terrorizing a city, and then I want the hologram Roy Orbison to like emerge from like the mountains in the distance, and for the two to clash. There's so much cool stuff that you could do with this technology, and it's they're just using it to put on weird little pantomime concerts. It's just a missed opportunity.
Do you think the holo craze is going to continue?
Oh God, yeah, like reality is over.
And we definitely need to call the podcast that. Reality is over. That's the...
So all right, so but yeah, I don't know. It is. I mean, there's with. I mean, I hate to sound like a VR proponent because I am on record as thinking that VR is stupid, but that technology is coming, and augmented reality is every few years there's a big augmented reality craze, and you got hologram Dio and hologram Orbison and all this. And it's just we're increasingly going to see the lines of what you can do in a performance blur between how much of that you can present with technology. And I don't know if it's sad because that makes me sound old. It just is, John.
Well, listen, let's talk about something that's flesh and bone. I'm going to play a track by Adam. Have I played the new album by Ellen and the Degenerates yet? I don't think I have.
If you haven't, you know,
well, even if I have, we're going to play it again. This band ruled, and they're breaking up because they hate me. They just put out a new album, their only album, and they're breaking up, and I hate them for it because I love the album so much. The album is called Return of the Herb, and I'm going to play a track off that new album. I'm not sure what track I'm going to play, but you'll be surprised. Meanwhile, get Return of the Herb by Ellen and the Degenerates. There's two shows left, and I hope I get to one. This band is awesome, and I'm sad they're breaking up, and boo, boo. Came in as three, and now there's two. Many are called, but few are chosen.
Well, Tom was called and chosen, and he had to leave. So that's how it works. So yeah, podcast at punknews.org is how you reach us if you want to. You know, you could send compliments for people that aren't Tom. That'd be cool.